Attention, please.
Comments made on the Serotalk podcast are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 68 for May 23, 2011. This is Michael Loft.
I'm Ricky Anger.
And I'm Joe Steinkamp.
A lot of stories to cover today. There was a lot happening with Google and some other, I think, very interesting news. A new study by Bitdefender, it's one of the security software packages out there, shows that 97% of people between the age of 18 and 65 have bought online with a credit card. But the disturbing fact is that 57% of people said that they replied to a fraudulent request for data. Can you believe that? 57%.
That's pretty scary. And I'm sure all of you have seen something like this where you get something from what purports to be PayPal and it says, you know, for to keeping your monies in a safe way, please provide us at your credential and login and passwords and such. And people are just looking at the from field and saying, oh, that's PayPal. I will reply to that and give them all my information, despite the fact that this doesn't really look particularly professional. So 57% of people doing that.
Yeah, that's very scary. So again, basic things, folk, like look at the web link. Is it the actual .com? Is it the PayPal.com or .com of your bank or something? Remember, your bank, your entities aren't going to be requesting that information via email. That's why I actually use text-based email so I can actually see the web link. And it's not just something I click on and I'm not sure where I'm going until I get there. And of course, the always infamous HTTPS secure server, although that could fraudulently be set up. But you make a very good point, the broken English, or the not what we think of as a U.S. English. So there's a lot of warning signs if you know. Just pay attention. Take those very seriously.
Exactly. Well, speaking of things that are not so much on the up and up, it looks like Apple is finally getting malware, and people are a little upset about this, and they're sort of saying, you know, Microsoft cares about your security, but Apple is just blowing you off. I don't think that's necessarily true. Macs have recently been hit with a fairly nasty bit of malware that displays some pretty inappropriate things on your machine if you click on the Mac Defender, I believe is what it's called. So it tries to look legitimate and is luring some users in. But the interesting thing is people are saying, you know, Microsoft cares about your security, but Apple doesn't. If you call an Apple representative, they will not fix the problem, but they will only point you to something like Sophos or Norton for Mac to get it fixed. The same is actually true for Microsoft. They're not going to fix your malware or virus issue either. They're going to point you to some tools that will do that for you. But the difference is that Mac users haven't really been trained to expect malware, whereas Microsoft is very security conscious and tries to educate its users. And, you know, for Mac, it's a little bit like, don't worry your pretty little head about viruses. You know, Macs are too shiny to be vulnerable. And that's obviously no longer true. So Apple's going to have to do a little education of its users to be more security conscious.
Well, it's not just that, Ricky. It's the ads.
I'm a Mac.
I'm a PC.
And they basically, very blatantly said, you don't get that stuff with us. You don't get viruses. We're free of that. I remember those ads very clearly. And I told you on this very podcast 2 years ago, I hate to say I told you so, but I said that once Apple becomes more popular, it will become a target.
And
sure enough, there it is. So my question, though, is to Mac users listening to this, are you using any antivirus or anti-malware software, or do you still feel it's no big deal? And if you are, we want to know which software is accessible and maybe which software you found to not be usable. Resources at serotalk.com or the Blab line at 866-997-BLAB. Facebook has leaked profiles and other personal information from millions of its users because of a years-old bug that overrides the individual privacy settings. I've never trusted those privacy settings, and I've heard a lot of that from friends and acquaintances of late, that things are being posted that they say they've set the privacy settings otherwise. But again, I want to ask you, what do you not do? Are you concerned about it? I know, like on birthday, I post my date of birth, but I don't post the year, and I really don't know why I post either. I guess it's kind of nice to get those happy birthday wishes, but so there's, you know, there's a lot of things you don't want to put out there. Mother's maiden names, obviously social security numbers, and
yeah, keep in mind not to put information out that would generally be used to answer some of these common security questions that are meant to verify who you are. Now, I don't care so much about the birthday thing, but obviously no social security number. I don't really post where I am at a particular time. I might, when I get back home, say where I've been. But again, no mother's maiden name. I don't really talk about the name of my first pet online, because those are things that, again, are used to verify who you are with security questions on several different sites.
So if you must use Facebook or choose to for branding and other reasons, Mashable offers Facebook PR Guide. And you get the link to that at serotalk.com.
This was an interesting read.
Yeah, it was. And the big one here is, once your client's page gets 25 likes, you can actually get your own vanity URL, such as facebook.com/yourbusiness.
And what's really interesting, and it makes a lot of sense, but I think a lot of people probably make this mistake, is that if you're going to have a Facebook page, you don't really want to be hawking your wares with a really hard sell. You know, Facebook is a place where people come to be entertained. They want some interesting content. They want something that they can't necessarily get anywhere else. So if you're just there on Facebook saying, buy our products right here because they are great, I don't think people are going to find your Facebook presence particularly fascinating.
Right. And that's kind of what a lesson I learned at first with Twitter. And it carries over into social networking really across the board. But you'll also find a link at serotalk.com on how to stay safe on Facebook and other social networking sites. Again, giving some other things like, do not give out the home address, Facebook, or as you said, you know, putting your home on Foursquare or actually checking in to the place where you live. Don't include photos that show others the layout of your home. Don't share info on vacation plans, especially the dates that you plan to be gone. And don't share your personal and IM email addresses also. So those and some other great suggestions. But all this stuff we're talking about in our super security mayhem section here.
That's right.
Over at serotalk.com.
I never quite understood, by the way, why people check into their home. I understand, and this is actually a question that comes up a lot about Foursquare, why do people use it at all? And some think it's just a way to tell people where you are. I would use it at a place like a convention where there are other Foursquare friends that I know, and we could perhaps find each other. But there are legitimate reasons to use Foursquare, and you don't have to link it to Facebook or Twitter, but you can check in to places which have coupons based on Foursquare check-ins. So you can actually save yourself a little money with it. But why you would check into your home, you know, I just ousted myself as mayor of my house on Foursquare. I don't quite get that.
Well, I thought I saw a post about someone using it to differentiate different buildings on a university campus.
Yeah, that was Daryl Shandro. He was using Foursquare as a mobility aid, which is kind of neat.
All right, a few things here in legislative news in the U.S. Congress. A new and very scary bill is making its way through, basically called the COKIA, I believe it is, 2.0, Internet Censorship Bill, also known as the Protect IP Act, basically allows the Department of Justice to force search engines and browsers to block user access to various websites and can basically scrub the internet clean that certain sites even exist. Of course, this is fueled by the motion picture industry, and attorney generals and even copyright holders can get sites blacklisted. Can you say kill the competition? Can you imagine that? People using it to kill their competitors, saying they're illegal operations.
This competitor has performed an illegal operation and will now be shut down.
Oh no. Yeah, I think it's not clear at all from the bill. I mean, there is no dividing line between what's appropriate to be blocked and what isn't. So it's a slippery slope.
So again, expounding some personal opinions here, so it's a Michael Loff and certainly not Serotech, but I hope you'll at least go read the petition. It's over at Demand Progress, and take a look at it, and then if you don't want to sign it, great, but at least be in the know and check it out, because if this comes into law, this is a very serious situation, so you can go read about it via serotalk.com and at least decide for yourself.
There's also a new bill that upgrades unauthorized internet streaming to a felony. Yes, a felony. So if you are streaming some copyrighted material and you don't have permission to do that, you could get quite a bit more than a slap on the wrist for that.
Yeah, it looks like 5 years in prison and a fine if you broadcast 10 or more public performances via electronic means within a 180-day period. And the total retail value is something like $2,500 or more than $5,000 in cost of licensing. So that's something really to think about, because a lot of people just do it for fun. You know, they'll broadcast maybe a Super Bowl or some kind of sports thing, and they just do it for their friends, and they're really not thinking, wow, there could be consequences to this. And of course, they're really talking more about movies here. I think certainly the movie makers, the studios, and theater owners are certainly the ones really behind supporting this bill. So a lot of the stuff we're talking about ultimately comes down from like the Motion Picture Association. And finally, an amendment in Congress for the first time requires that the government get a warrant to obtain email and other content stored in the cloud. And again, this is very important because, you know, in the past, they didn't have to have this. And with information being in the cloud, your data could be accessed and you not be made aware of it. Or you have situations where even companies, say, give you the right to set up a password that even the company doesn't have to protect your documents and so forth. So, you know, either the government then's mandating they have some kind of system on the back end to give it if they want it. But that's good. I think there should be some probable cause and some kind of warrant so you are aware if the government is brute forcing their way in to look at your data. So I think that's a good thing. Oh, a lot of stuff here in Google land, a lot of news, but it's very interesting news. Joe will talk here in a minute about the Google I.O. conference. But first up here, it looks like 99% of Android phones leak secret account credentials.
Oops.
They can access your calendars, contacts, and other sensitive data. I think even Facebook, maybe, and Twitter info stored on Google servers. Looks like the client log in Android versions 2.3.3 and earlier, and they've proven this at Rice University as well as another institution, that it is possible, especially within 14 days of setting up these accounts. I guess there's a text-based token that's alive for 14 days. And again, so it's not only the stuff on the Google servers, but Facebook and Twitter and Google Calendar. So the only good news is these attacks can only be carried out when you're using unsecured networks such as a coffee shop or some kind of Wi-Fi hotspot.
Which probably happens a lot, though.
Well, of course it does.
The good news is they fixed it in 2.3.4, but the bad news is many carriers aren't pushing that out as an update yet.
Yep.
So even though Google has done what it needs to do, you're still sort of at the whim of your carrier as to when your OS is going to become more secure.
Yeah, and it also affects if any of our listeners with some vision are using Picasso. That hole hasn't been closed yet either. So, one of the biggest stories to me from Google is that Google is quietly, not so quietly now because we're telling you about it, but quietly lobbying the legislature in Nevada to allow autonomous vehicles on public roads. That's right. Google has created a line of self-driving hybrids, including 6 Toyota Priuses and an Audi TT. These vehicles have already been tested on over 140,000 miles of California roads, and at least 1,000 miles have been driven autonomously. That's right. No human intervention.
How cool is that?
That's awesome. These two bills should come before vote by the end of June. So, hey, maybe when we go out to ACB in July, we can get Google to come out.
Yeah, we'll be able to take a ride in the Google car. One thing came up in this that I had never even considered. as a part of lobbying for these self-driving cars, they're also having to lobby for an exception in the texting while driving rule. So you, as the human backup, should actually have the ability to text while, quote, driving because the car is doing it for you.
I don't like that, because that is my only fear, is that when, and inevitably it will happen, the car makes some mistake and human intervention is required, that you're going to be so used to that vehicle taking care of business, you're going to be grabbing a little power nap or texting or something, and you're not going to notice it. How do you pronounce this? Providi, P-R-O-V-I-D-I, offers the My Accessible Google, or MAG. This is a series, or will be, I guess, a series of web apps to make using Google applications easier for blind and low vision persons. The initial offering is Google Calendar, which still only offers partial access from the people I've talked to who have used it, and you can only use it with your primary calendar. You must have a Gmail account, and you must create your calendar first before this app can access it. Have you played with it yet? I know you were really advocate of making.
Yeah, I was really jumping up and down and excited about this, because that's been sort of the bane of my existence, not to be able to access a shared Google Calendar, which I still can't with this service yet, but I have played with it. It does work very well. I submitted some feedback to the guys at Providi, and did get an immediate response. So there are a couple of things that they're working on fixing, but again, they do appear to be very responsive to feedback, and it does work. You can enter a natural language type appointment. So you could say, podcast recording from 10 to 12 p.m. on Friday, and it would put in your calendar the appropriate date and have you blocked out for the appropriate time, so you don't necessarily have to choose that from a drop-down list. Again, this is a really great first step, and I look forward to being able to use other Google apps, although I hate that it's necessary for a third party to come along and make these apps accessible rather than Google stepping up to the plate and doing it themselves.
Especially when you consider that, universities and schools are wanting to go directly to using Google.
Yeah, and with good reason.
Yeah.
I mean, they've done a lot right. They just did one major thing wrong, and that is that they didn't make the apps accessible.
Well, if you need an accessible RSS feed reader for your Android device, check out WebTalks. It works on both online and offline content. You can read the offline content if you preload it. And you can learn more about that by visiting webtalks.es, just like it sounds, webtalks.es.
Well, the Android-iOS debate is something that seems to be continually raging. But here's a pretty nicely done, level-headed article that talks about 10 things you can do with Android that absolutely cannot be done with iOS devices. And that includes iOS devices that have been unlocked / jailbroken. I'm not going to go through the entire list here, but there are a few very cool things, such as there's some automation that you can do with an app called Tasker, where, for example, it can look at your location, and if it sees that you're pulling into your driveway, it can turn Wi-Fi back on. And, when you pull out of your driveway and get a certain number of miles, feet, whatever, from your house, it can switch to 3G and turn Wi-Fi off entirely. A couple of other things you can do include using custom ROMs, and these are things where somebody has tweaked phone settings. They may have added a couple of bits of functionality that aren't there in the stock Android firmware. You're able to use things like CyanogenMod. This is one thing that Mike Calvo's pretty excited about. He spoke about that briefly during our town meeting. And there are others, but it's a way to get access to things in your phone like FM radios. A lot of these phones do have radios like that, but they aren't enabled in the version of Android which ships with your phone. So these and plenty of other cool things that you can do with Android, but not iOS, can be found in this article at saratalk.com.
I like just the ability to quickly plug in the device and copy things to and from files, music and pictures and things without having to bring iTunes into the equation. So that rocks my world when I play with Android. Yeah. Well, a petition has been started as we record this, has 146 signatures asking Google basically to make mods to Android so that blind people can set it up themselves without initially requiring sighted assistance. Maybe a couple other things, but it's a pretty basic petition, and you can go read that and sign it if you like. We'll link at serotalk.com. Well, a big event just took place called Google I.O., and there was a lot of stuff mentioned there for accessibility. We're not going to go into everything, but we have all links over at serotalk.com. But now we're going to bring in Joe Steinkamp to kind of tell us what were some of the highlights of Google I.O. What rocked your world there, Joe?
There was a lot coming out of it. In fact, the show notes are going to have a lot of links to YouTube videos where you can get a lot of information about what was said at Google I.O., that being input-output, because it's the old geeky thing over at Google. The music streaming service was announced. This is really interesting, but also has a huge downside on the front part, which is you can actually upload your music, and right now it's called Music Beta, but eventually it'll go out to other Android devices and tablets. You can upload your music to Google, and then that music is available in the cloud for streaming. Now, it will hold up to 20,000 titles, and it takes a while, as you might imagine, if you have a slow internet connection to load that up there. People like Leo Laporte and Jason Howell and others have said that it's taken them 3 or 4 days, but once when they've gotten it up there, it is available for streaming, and you can get to all of that from an Android device or a tablet or something like that. So it's pretty painful on the front end if you have a lot of songs, but once when it's up there, it's there.
I wonder why they took this approach rather than saying, let me scan your drive or your collection and see the stuff that you have access to and just unlock access to it. Because, yeah, storage is cheap, but this is a little bit ridiculous. You're going to have, you know, 200 million people uploading their Beatles box sets when there really only needs to be one stored somewhere.
And there's a lot of different services who do this a little differently, like RDO, and certainly the Amazon streaming service that was announced a couple of months ago is a little different in how they do it. Some services do it as an unlock. So they do a Scrabbler, look at your hard drive, see what's available, and then they unlock the corresponding songs. I would imagine, because this is a bit for bit, it's your property being loaded up there so you can stream it. And, you know, the there's a lot of gray areas when it's coming to streaming right now as far as the music industry is concerned. And certainly we'll know a lot more about how Apple's going to do it next month at WWDC, because the rumor is that they're going to have a streaming music service from their acquisition of Lala a couple of years ago. This is probably the future of music, and it's definitely going to be very interesting. And I think Google felt like one way or another they had to be involved. And there was a lot of rumors coming into I.O. that they were trying to work out deals with the record companies so you could purchase it. Because that's another downside, is that you can't add to it. There's no way to purchase songs and then add them to your cloud. So, you know, for a 1.0, this is kind of where they are. Certainly, it's Google, and the beta tag has remained on Gmail for 7 years before I think they took it off or something like that. So anything is possible the way they go. But also, what came out of this was them trying to address fragmentation in Google land. You have many different handsets out there, several on different versions of Android. And what they kind of slyly announced was that operating systems running 2.2 and higher would see updates. In fact, phones that are coming out now would see about 18 months of updates. And then after that, it would kind of be phone-specific or carrier-specific and feature-specific, because naturally the fragmentation is so much so that certain hardware devices can do certain other things, like Integra devices actually have code written specifically for Integra videos of tablets and handsets. And of course, the Netflix announcement that came shortly before Google I.O. only runs on certain types of phones that can support what Netflix is doing.
What about accessibility stuff? What sorts of things did they cover there? I know that the Orion was actually showcased as a cool gadget during the event. And I guess they also talked about Chromevox. And I think they actually had a I'm not entirely sure how this works, but like a mock-up of a screen reader?
Yeah, Chrome Shades is what they announced that will work with Chrome. It's an extension that you can load into Chrome and simulate a screen reader. So visually, they can kind of get an idea of how data is going to be represented or presented to an individual. They actually have one for low vision users, too. I've not really used that. That's specifically with the Chrome browser to be able to get an idea of how to build a better website. They also had several videos up on YouTube for talks on making accessibility through HTML5 or captioning in videos or how to have Android apps work better with accessibility. And they don't just cover blindness, they actually cover multiple disabilities and talk a lot about usability as well. And they do have Braille displays up on stage that they were running Braille 2 from Chrome, and they didn't, that I could tell, have it directly linked through Android, because certainly that's been a sticking point. But what they did talk about is that the Open Accessibility API, the Open Accessory API was announced. And what that is a way for third parties to make their own connections to Android. And for that, you could do, let's say, like you were talking about earlier with Tasker and stuff, you could actually write drivers that would allow your lamps to then connect to Tasker, and then it would turn them on and off. And it could hook into your refrigerator or your stove. And, you know, remember those old Microsoft homes of the future kind of thing where, you know, when I walk in, blah will happen. Or, you know, the microwave will start and cook that potato I left in there 5 hours earlier. That's where we're going, is that these drivers would be available to work with Android a lot better. Now, where that works for accessibility is that this gives us a way to maybe do Braille displays with Android. And that's really where it's going to go, because the modern community, the third-party guys, they're just going to take this and really go to town on it. And I think we're going to see an extreme, once again, like we said in March during the tech chat, I think the Wild Wild West days, we're going to see people pioneering and going out into the frontier and doing some amazing stuff in Android. So we have a lot of links in the show notes if you want to catch up with what happened at Google I.O. There's a lot of these YouTubes. They're really good talks. They're kind of dry, so I warn you ahead of time, if you're interested, get a pillow for some of it, because you're going to want to rest up, because it's a lot of video.
All right, and the other stuff beyond Google Land, this would also be one of my favorite stories right up there with the self-driving vehicles. But to help give every kid in school a computer, a gentleman has created a computer on a USB stick. Basically, a USB port on one end to plug in the keyboard, and on the other end, an HDMI connector for video. This has been created for a cost of only $25. Or should I say, will be created. You cannot buy one just yet. But the hardware is a 700 megahertz ARM processor with 128 meg of RAM, and it runs on OpenGLS 2.0, offering 1080p video output.
I think they've tried several Linux distributions, and they're probably going to settle on Ubuntu. But the idea is to be able to hand this out to kids everywhere and make sure that they have a machine, and it's very economically viable to do that. There's storage in the form of an SD card slot, and apparently there's a way that you can hook up a 12.1 megapixel camera to this thing, which is really interesting. Now, unfortunately, they don't say anything about sound for the device. That doesn't mean it isn't there. It's just not laid out in the specs in this article.
Yeah, I wonder if that's done through the HDMI, or that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know how they would do that. And I'm having a hard time imagining just how large or small this thing is. I mean, they're packing a whole lot of hardware into something that's $25. I guess you can put it in your pocket.
Right, when you call it a USB stick, you're thinking this thing's plugging into a USB port. So even if it's just a little bit wider than a standard USB device, which maybe could block two ports on certain machines, but
yep.
Yeah, without seeing it and, you know, wondering how durable it is. I mean, I'm notorious for breaking those sticks. I end up bending them eventually.
Ah, yes, me too. Well, in the category of slightly more expensive hardware than $25, it looks like Apple is going to be refreshing their line of MacBook Airs in July. So you'll see these MacBook Airs with the Sandy Bridge processors as well as the Thunderbolt, which was just introduced in the MacBook Pro line that was refreshed in February.
Well, a lot of people said they were interested in the Airs, but thought the processors were too slow. So with those new Sandy Bridge processors, those things should scream. So we'll be curious to see the adoption
indeed.
Rate or what the cost is going to be. And again, our next podcast will fall around June 7, and there we will give you coverage, the highlights of WWDC, so we'll find out definitely what's new in Apple land. Well, last podcast, we talked about what was going to happen with Skype. There was all kinds of rumors. Google was looking at it. Facebook was looking at it. But actually, Microsoft bought Skype for a whopping $8.5 billion, or will buy it, of course, pending regulatory approval for that. But hopefully all will go through by the end of 2011. And it was an interesting article because it said, really, why did Microsoft buy it? They already have these technologies in place. They have audio and video capabilities. But Skype will be run as a new division within Microsoft. The plan is to bring Skype support into things like Xbox and Kinect. And maybe of greatest interest to us is support in Office. That'll be cool. Like an Outlook, your contacts, and make a Skype call or something. Which, of course, they already have call to commands if you know how to do it. But yeah, to integrate that into Office or Windows Phone 7.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did this because they kind of had to. And it doesn't really matter what they do with it. If they hadn't gotten it, Google would. Microsoft and Google are kind of battling on a lot of different fronts, and Microsoft is a bit behind in a lot of ways. They certainly don't have the market leader in mobile phones, and they aren't the market leader in cloud-based solutions. So there are a lot of things that Google is doing that Microsoft really wants a piece of, and I think getting Skype was a move to say, no, no, Google, you can't have that. We'll take that and we'll figure out what to do with it once we've gotten it.
Well, Microsoft says they will still support clients running on other operating systems. So hopefully those of us using Skype on the Mac and iOS and even Android will still be supported. And hopefully they can resolve, like many people, I thought Skype up to maybe 6 months ago worked just fantastic. And then something happened that degraded the reliability of it. A lot of breakup and just jittery audio and video. So hopefully they can resolve that. And of course, I was also concerned, someone explained to me that Skype uses peer-to-peer for sending all those data packets. And of course, if certain entities on the internet have their way, they'd like to outlaw that P2P technology because it's used for illegal activities.
Yes, I hadn't even considered that. Yeah, Skyping was once considered a verb. Now I think it's synonymous with a curse word just in the last 6 months.
I'm gonna skip you.
You better not.
Vision Australia has called on the Gillard government to replace hundreds of free set-top boxes that were installed in the homes of vision-impaired pensioners across Victoria and South Australia because they could not fully operate them. Now, the Australian government is trialing some new text-to-speech set-top boxes that they will need to when they implement digital TV by 2013. And we'll hear later in this podcast a demo of a set-top box being used in the UK. John Gallagher from Leeds gives us that info. And again, we asked for that in the last podcast, and he delivers. So again, if you have some cool technology out there you're playing with and you'd love to share it with others, by all means, record an MP3 or something and send it over to us, and we'd be glad to share your expertise with the world. Users of Firefox under Linux now have another speech engine to play with called KTTSD. I don't know what else to say about it.
Well, it's actually just a Firefox extension where you can select text and have that rendered to speech. I'm not entirely sure why you would want this if you have a full-fledged screen reader, but there may be cases where you don't need a screen reader all the time, but you just want to be able to have your news read to you and that sort of thing. So this is perfect for that.
You know, hopefully it doesn't become one of those, oh, I'm building a website, let me make sure it's usable by the blind, and I'll just run this little, yeah.
Yes.
The narrator for Linux.
Oh, no.
Well, another thing I don't have much to say about other than that Sendero has released their GPS 2011, and it offers 7 changes or updates, and you can read about that at Sendero itself website or blindbargains.com or serotalk.com and find out if that's worth the upgrade to you. It does look like it has some cool features in it. Humanware has released the Victor Reader Stratus. And in the future, it will support 3G wireless capabilities, but doesn't as of today.
Now, this is the portable CD book player, not the smaller portable, strictly digital Daisy player. The interesting thing about this is that it has been outfitted with a cappella Heather text-to-speech, and I can't help but wonder if we will see that moving over to the smaller HumanWare digital players in the near future.
I don't know if they have enough memory to support that. We'd have to see.
Well, they'd certainly have to do a hardware refresh, and it's probably about time for that.
Will they do that or just come out with a new piece of hardware? I guess we'll find out what HumanWare will be doing in the future on that front. The National Library Service, or Library of Congress, is actually looking for a Braille programming specialist with a salary between $74,000 and $97,000. I don't know what makes a difference. If you only ask for 74, is that all you get? Or I guess it depends on your skill sets. But we wanted to mention that because we have a lot of Braille enthusiasts listening to this show, and I would love nothing more than to hear they heard about it through Serotalk. But you can apply. Deadline for that is June 17. A new blog post outlines a comparison of the current lines of video magnifiers, 7 inches or less. You can read about that over at accesstechnews.blogspot.com, or again, get the link at serotalk.com.
We've also got a couple of articles covering accessible and free internet radio programs. One of them is called Mozecti. Is that how you pronounce this? Also have Tap-In Radio and Radio Shore, which I believe was reviewed on a past podcast, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mozecti, basically we, and by we meaning Bill Sparks and myself, found this to be useless. The reason some people were enamored with it is it has a built-in text-to-speech component to it, but it's just really not very usable. It doesn't offer very much in the way of feeds. Radio Shore was reviewed in the past, and it's probably the most accessible of the three programs, but many of the stations don't work. That's the problem with a lot of these apps, is the database is outdated. So my favorite of the three, although again, I can't recommend it for everyone, but my favorite is called Tap In Radio. It has the most working links of radio stations. It works great with system access, but unfortunately not other screen readers. Definitely died in the water with window eyes, and I didn't try NVDA or anything else to see how it stood up there. It may not be the most intuitive, but it has a lot of cool features. You can add favorites, and it just does a lot of... I really like this program for some particular reason. So my pick of the three would be Tap In Radio, and it is absolutely free. And of course, there's always the radio component to SamNet with thousands of radio stations and a built-in media player and the bookmarks capability. So if you want that as an easy to use, don't want to play with a standalone piece of software, that's your fourth option out there as well.
Right on. And while we're on the subject of self-promotion, how about let's talk about the last couple of tech chats, which have been fantastic and lots of fun. If you're a person with an iOS device and you like gaming, then you're certainly going to want to check out Tech Chat 101. We cover a whole lot of different iOS games. Special guest Michael Fair, and we had Kwasi Mensa from Anansi Productions. They are the developers of Stem Stumper, which has become rather popular among the blindness community. This is an audio game where you walk around chomping fertilizer, and you have to be concerned with flower power and all sorts of other fun stuff. It truly is a very fun game. A lot of thought went into the design of this game, and you can hear Kwasi talk about this on Tech Chat 101 and sort of discuss how the development process took place. And Tech Chat 102, this one's for the ladies or for anybody else who likes wearing makeup and such. And had special guests Kara Quinn and Maureen Duffy from VisionAware. And we also had Alyssa Minwell, who is 17 and has already begun selling her own jewelry. So we talked about all sorts of things ranging from color analysis to how do you paint your nails as a blind woman.
That's right, and clothing and finding your colors and jewelry. And Alyssa makes some really cool jewelry. And I thought this was just cool. Wind chimes made out of seashells. That was just really cool.
Yes,
stuff.
And we didn't have nearly enough time on that show. I guarantee there will be Fashion, the sequel.
Well, here's another first we're excited about. Minnesota Representative Winstrom has become the first blind person in the U.S. to lead the House in a debate. So congratulations. I wonder how many blind or low vision folks we have in various either, you know, state legislatures around the country. wonder if anyone, maybe I talked to someone at AFB about that. I'm just curious how...
Yeah, I'm curious about that too, because only certain members tend to get a lot of publicity. You know, there was, of course, Governor Patterson, and that's really the only one I can think of.
That we know of, but I mean, you know, it's like when I got into radio, I thought there was only three people, but then I found out there were many in almost every state.
Right, there are a lot of them.
You just don't know about it. I mean, people just quietly do what they do and just integrate. Well, if you're hungry, we found a new resource for you. Recipe ideas galore. It's called foodily.com, foodily.com, with, just for starters, over 17,000 bacon recipes.
Yeah. What is it with geeks and bacon? There seems to be this kind of obsession. I just find it funny that they highlighted bacon here. But there's that site, I think it's baconfreak.com, and, you know, you can get the chocolate-covered bacon and all this other stuff. But this is really fantastic, because not only can you get more than you ever wanted to know about how to cook bacon, but you can search for recipes excluding certain ingredients. You can search for things that sort of fall into a particular category, you know, low carb, low sugar, low fat, that sort of thing. So it's a great way to search several different sites. It goes through blogs as well as things like Food Network and other places that typically publish recipes, and it returns all these happy results for you.
Right. So if you can search by dietary needs, so if you're type 2 diabetic or high cholesterol, you can factor that in and get recipes relevant for you. I'm a true geek because I did the math and realized that 17,000, that means I could have a different bacon recipe every morning for 50 years.
Whoa.
Sweet. Doesn't get much better than that.
No.
Well, if you like drinking coffee with your bacon and you happen to own a Tassimo, you may be in for a bit of disappointment. I know I was. It appears that Kraft is no longer partnering with Starbucks to produce Tassimo tea discs. So there are certainly still other tea discs made by companies like Javalia, Seattle's Best, a few others. But the one coffee that I really enjoyed on the Tassimo was Starbucks, and it is now gone. Well, it's almost gone. They've stopped producing it, but there are still boxes of Starbucks coffee out in the wild, so you want to snap those up while you can. Yesterday, I purchased a Keurig coffee brewer, and Starbucks is expected to come to that brewer during the summer.
Yeah, Keurig, I didn't realize, captured 80% of what we're talking about is the single cup market. If you listen to some of our previous podcasts where Mike Cabo demoed his Tassimo, and then we did the Keurig with the K-Cups. I like the taste of the Keurig better, but like you said, there's some special lattes. There's a few things you can do with the Tassimo that you can't with the Keurig.
You know, I don't like the taste of the Keurig better, and I'm hoping that Starbucks changes my mind. The problem, at least with the model that I have, which is the B60, is that you have three cup sizes, small, medium, and large, and the larger the cup size, the weaker the coffee. So the brew strength doesn't appear to increase at all. It's almost like it's just dumping more water into this cup of coffee. And if you brew a small cup, which is 4 ounces, that's like nothing. If you do that, then you get a nice, strong-tasting cup of coffee.
Welcome to Geeks and Coffee, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
That's right.
Bacon and caffeine, they go together. That's today's motto.
Bacon and caffeine together at last.
Speaking of needing caffeine and breakfast, another related item is that more than half of adults in the U.S. suffer from some symptoms of insomnia at least a few nights every week. And 1 in 5, or 21%, wake up either too early and can't go back to sleep, or have trouble going to sleep in the first place. And CNN says that the lack of sleep may be the nation's top health problem. Coming up in the podcast, we'll tell you about a new medication to help blind folks with sleep problems, and how you can even make money by participating in a sleep research study with Vanda Pharmaceuticals. That's coming up in just a few minutes on Serotalk.
And certainly there are other ways, which this article covers, that don't include medication for being able to sleep better. And those include not drinking caffeine after 12 p.m. and actually dimming your lights beginning about 3 hours before you plan to go to sleep. Even for blind people, this is effective, apparently. So good stuff in this article.
Oh, yeah, even having TV sets on can affect this light. I always wonder about computer, you know, screens and so forth, but you can pose those questions to an upcoming tech chat on June 9th as well.
The TV thing is really important because I used to, when I traveled on the road a lot, I used to sleep in hotels and I would leave it on, like, say, MSNBC or something, and it would repeat every 2 hours or 3 hours or something. And I would always seem to wake up 3 hours into the same story that I had fallen asleep into. So it was like no time had passed. It was like Twilight Zone.
It's Groundhog Day.
Exactly. Wait a minute. I just heard that story about the president. What just happened?
Wow. Crazy.
Well, our final story looks like a team in Sweden have developed an electronic wheelchair, they put it, that can see for its users. The wheelchair has a joystick that serves as a steering device and a haptic robot that acts as a virtual white cane. Now, the folks who've tested it says it works pretty good, but it doesn't detect obstacles above or below a certain point, so they want to implement a 3D camera, and they say really production of this unit would still be at least 5 years out.
Yeah, that's a good long time from now, but I love this concept. I know blind wheelchair users who have trained with a guide dog, but I've never seen a blind wheelchair user with a cane. I'm not entirely sure kind of what the drawbacks and the challenges are with that, but this obviously seems like a really good idea. And hey, yeah, maybe you could just bypass all this stuff by getting some duct tape and putting that Kinect camera and strapping on the big laptop and all that stuff to your head. So,
or better yet, why don't you just partner with Google and make a self-autonomous wheelchair?
Autonomous wheelchair. I like it.
Well, folks, that's all we have. We hope you'll stay tuned for our two great segments on improving the quality of your sleep, as well as hearing at least the first set-top box that talks, and we'll find out its strengths and a couple weaknesses with it from the UK, and hopefully something coming to the US very soon as well. And don't forget to join us in 2 weeks on June 7, as we'll be giving you the latest and greatest coming out of Apple with WWDC.
Thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks.
Today on the Sarah Talk Podcast, we're bringing back a guest we've spoken with about a year ago. It's Joseph T. Hull with Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard, and we're going to talk about sleep research and a problem that affects many blind and low-vision persons, and that's the lack of a proper 24-hour sleep-wake cycle. Joe, thanks for joining us again, Sarah.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me on again.
Okay, so I guess there's been some new information since our last tech chat, which was definitely a bit over a year ago, and there was a lot of participation that evening, as I recall. But what have we found out, and what are you doing at Harvard?
So currently, we ran two studies that were similar to studies that my colleague and mentor, Dr. Stephen Lockley, had been doing over in England, where we've been assessing the sleep-wake rhythms of totally blind, meaning they have no light perception. These individuals usually exhibit, not everyone, but usually many of them exhibit a cyclic sleep-wake disorder, which is referred to as a non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder. And this disorder can be a little bit different between individuals. It has a tendency to have the symptoms of, which most sleep disorders have, is difficulty sleeping at night on a regular basis, and also having difficulty remaining alert during the daytime. So there's excessive daytime sleepiness that's occurring. And this seems to have a cyclic pattern where individuals will have periods where they're not sleeping well at night and having trouble staying awake and alert during the daytime. And then suddenly these symptoms kind of go away for a few days in some individuals, maybe even a week or two in other people. But then progressively the symptoms of insomnia, nighttime insomnia, return, and the daytime sleepiness increases and the urge to want to nap during the daytime increases. And we found that it's because of the lack of light input to the body clock, which helps regulate the sleep-wake cycle. And the sleep-wake cycle is regulated by two processes, one that counts the amount of hours that you're awake, and as you're awake more and more time, the pressure to sleep increases. And we usually get rid of this pressure to sleep after we fall asleep. And so during the first few hours of the night, we get rid of the sleep pressure when we fall asleep. What helps us stay asleep during the nighttime for a full 8 hours is the body clock, which is usually synchronized with the rising and setting of the sun, which the body clock receives a signal about the time of day through the eyes. But in many blind individuals who do not have no light perception, where their retinas or their optic nerve have been damaged on both eyes, no light can get to the body clock to tell it this time of day signal. And so what happens is the body clock doesn't cycle, or it doesn't have a 24-hour cycle that's exact. And what happens is the timing that it promotes sleep during the latter half of the night, after we've released all that sleep pressure during the first 4 hours or 5 hours of sleep, it helps us stay asleep for another 3 or 4 hours so that we stay asleep for about 8 hours. In addition, it also has a wake-promoting signal. People stay awake for about 16 hours, and as we reach about the 6th to 10th hour, sleep pressure is very great. And what the body clock does is also send a wake-promoting signal to counteract this growing sleep pressure during the hours that we're awake during the daytime. But in a blind individual, this wake-promoting signal will start to occur later and later each day, as well as that sleep-promoting signal in the middle of the night, because the body clock is cycling. That's a little bit greater than 24 hours. So we've been trying to figure out what would be the best way to try to reset the clock. Is there another way to do this since light can't do it anymore? And studies by Dr. Lockley and other groups here in the U.S. have shown that giving a melatonin pill every night before an individual goes to bed can help reset their body clock. But this usually has to coincide with when a person's own endogenous melatonin is being produced. But we produce it ourselves through our pineal gland, and the body clock controls the timing of this release of our own internal melatonin. And usually the melatonin in a sighted individual is always being released in the middle of the night. We usually know that this always occurs every night for them because the light is getting through their eyes to reset their body clock. And we know that in some blind individuals, their melatonin rhythm is no longer happening in the nighttime. It's occurring about 20 or 30 minutes later each day. And we can do this by assessing urine samples for about a 48-hour period each week. People produce about 10 samples over that 48 hours each week, and we can find when the peak levels of melatonin are occurring. Usually in a sighted person, they're always occurring around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning if they go to bed from 12 to 8. In many blind people, not all, but a majority, we have seen that their melatonin is occurring later and later each day by about 20 minutes to about 30 minutes on average. And in some of the studies that Dr. Lockley has done, he has waited until this secretion occurs during the nighttime when the person is usually going to bed like everybody else in this 24-hour society. And by taking the pill every night when their own melatonin is starting to be released in the evening hours, let's say about 9 p.m., the individual would take the pill about 30 minutes before their bedtime if it was around 10, and take it every day. And it seemed that in a majority, not all the subjects that participated in these studies, the melatonin being taken every day acted like a time cue, like the rising and setting of the sun through the eyes, where it actually signaled the body clock and reset it so that these individuals, their melatonin was occurring every night. And this seemed to cause those sleep disruptions and interruptions of sleepiness during the daytime to be alleviated. And as they continued to take the melatonin pill every night, they had consolidated sleep. They were able to sleep about 7 hours to 8 hours each night, given that they allowed that amount of time in bed. And the daytime sleepiness related to this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder was also alleviated in a majority of them.
Okay, so since melatonin doesn't work for everyone, and because some people just can't figure out the right time to begin taking it to get that synchronization that you're talking about, another company, Vanda Pharmaceuticals, has come up with an alternative medication that is currently in test trials, right? And that's part of what we're speaking about today, is that they are looking for totally blind persons who are willing to maybe take part in this sleep study and actually, if accepted, actually be compensated for their participation and maybe help them really resolve sleep issues, which affect more than just us being tired in a day. They affect our mood and productivity and anxiety and a number of things. We also have with us here William Hoos with Vanda Pharmaceuticals. And William, if you could talk a little bit about this sleep research study and what you're looking for in potential candidates to help you get approval.
A little bit on the study. So Vanda is a small biopharmaceutical company based near Washington, D.C. Our study is ongoing for a investigational medication to treat this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder and evaluate whether the drug is safe and efficacious for that purpose. So the goals of the study are to determine whether the drug increases nighttime sleep and decreases daytime napping, and whether it stabilizes the body clock. So the drug's called tasimelteon. It is not approved by the FDA, and it's being compared to a placebo, which is a sugar pill, to see if it works. The study has three parts. The first part is that the screening and diagnosis to determine eligibility to take part in the study. One of the nice parts about the study is for those who participate in the first part of it, they get to go through the diagnostic process that Dr. Hull was mentioning, where the melatonin signal is measured in the body over the period of a month, and it's determined whether it's stable and staying the same, or whether it's moving across time and probably the underlying cause of the sleep problems. So that's the first part of the study. It's about a month. The second part of the study is the evaluation of the safety and efficacy of the drug compared to the placebo. That period is about 6 months. The entire study takes place in the home. There are doctor visits about once a month during the study, but beyond that, everything is taking place in the home. Samples are collected in the home. The drug's taken in the home. It's a pill taken every night. The sleep information is recorded by a diary through a phone-in call-in system. Third part is an optional extension where everyone gets the active drug if they choose to continue with the third part for an additional 6 months.
Okay, so during phase two, you may be getting the medication, or you may be getting a placebo. You may compare whether the pill is truly having the effect or if it's psychosomatic, where people may just think that they're getting some kind of medication, and that's part of that whole FDA approval process, I assume. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So the randomized placebo-controlled study is the gold standard of the drug approval process and of the scientific clinical trial process. Comparing against that placebo, psychosomatic, other causes there might be, is exactly what we're doing. One of the nice things is in the study, we're able to look at whether that body clock gets stabilized as well.
Who qualifies? What is the screening process? What are you looking for in terms of age and gender?
There's several criteria, but the simple ones are individuals who are between 18 and 75 have reported some level of trouble falling asleep, staying asleep in the last 3 months, and they're totally blind.
Okay, so no vision at all. They must be totally blind. No light perception, anything. Is that correct?
That's correct. For those who have little to no light perception, if they think they may be a fit, they're encouraged to call and do the formal assessment.
Now, you mentioned doctor visits, so some people, of course, may be concerned about traveling to and from. Are those centralized locations that Vanda picks up the tab for them, whether they need to fly or take a bus to get to these locations once a month? How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have about 20 research sites around the country in the U.S. There's actually also some sites in Germany. This information's on our website. The answer directly to the transportation is the study sites do provide all transportation to and from the facility for all the visits. And, you know, we do have some people traveling a couple hours, and we provide assisted transportation service for that to make sure it's something that's agreeable for the participant. So we want to make sure that the participant is taking the time and understanding the benefits and risks, and we want to accommodate and make it as easy as possible.
What is the compensation structure? I assume there's some for finishing the first phase and then additional revenue for completing the second phase. How does that work?
That's right. So the specific amounts on the compensation are really best left for the discussion with our research sites after someone calls in and expresses interest. The payment for the participation is essentially payment for the time and effort for being in the study. All the medication, all the doctor visits, all of those are, of course, provided. But then there's additional compensation that is paid as you go along. So there's never any obligation to continue any kind of clinical trial. Someone can change their mind along the way, and there's no penalties or no pressure in that way. So the specifics on the compensation are best left for people who are interested. They need to hear about the details and make an informed decision about whether to participate.
Okay, well, now that we've whet their appetites, let's tell them about we are doing a tech chat on June 9th, where not only can you ask any questions you have about sleep research or difficulties you may have, but also some questions about the study, excluding those, of course, who are currently in the study. Find out all those things they want to know about sleep research. And of course, if you haven't done so, you can go back through our archives and listen to a tech chat, which I'll link to, that we did with Joe about a year ago. And I thought it was very interesting. A lot of great questions.
The number of people that had joined the Saratalk chat was quite impressive. And I did get many questions via email.
So the goal for the tech chat session is to give everybody a chance to ask their questions about the science, the background, the types of symptoms that are out there related to this. You know, why does this exist? Why is it related to light? Why is it related to total blindness? What's some of the research that's been done in the past? We'll hopefully be able to answer questions about participation in the study.
If folks can't wait until June 9, why don't you go ahead and give a website or phone number so folks can learn more about it and see if they'd like to participate in the study?
Sure. We have an 800 number that if someone's already interested, they can go ahead and call the 800 number or send an email. The number is 888-389-7033. That's 888-389-7033. And the email is info@non24registry.com. That's non24registry, registry.com. That number and email are set up so that people can call and learn more. And if they're interested in being part of they take a brief survey about their sleep issues. And then if they're interested in learning more about the study and specifically, we have our research sites call them and go through the rest of the process. And for everyone who takes one of those surveys and calls in, $25 is donated to one of the national support organizations. That's an option. There's also information on our website, which is vandapharma.com, VandaPharma.com. And if you want to go directly to the page, it's vandapharma.com/TASI3201.html. So that's TASI3201.html.
And of course, as always, we'll have the link over at serotalk.com. Okay, well, folks, if you would like to submit your questions in advance so we can make sure that these gentlemen have an opportunity to answer them, either if you can't join us live or just to make sure that your questions are covered, you can email them in advance to resources@serotalk.com. That's resources@serotalk.com. Or call what we call the Blab Line. It's a toll-free number in the U.S. and Canada, and you can leave a voice message with your questions. Toll-free number is 866-997-BLAB. That's 866-997-2522. I thank both you gentlemen for sharing this information, and we look forward to speaking with both of you on June 9 when we will delve much deeper into the topic of sleep disorders among the blind and, most importantly, some real-world solutions that we can all use to benefit and improve the quality of our life. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi everyone, this is John Gallagher from Leeds in the United Kingdom doing a very brief podcast on the Talking Goodman's set-top box. Just got this a couple of weeks ago and show people how it does work. Along with the remote, you've also got the little box, a bit smaller than a braille note. It's not very heavy. You've got different plugs on the back of it where you can plug the power lead, the SCART lead, the aerial connector. We'll switch this on. A blind person can set it up. The remote control is got quite a lot of buttons, I must admit. You've got probably 25, 30 buttons. The number 5 has obviously got sort of two dots at the side of it. So I'm going to press top right and hold it in. That should turn our television on. It's a very small, flat screen, portable, this television. We'll just hope that we can demo this speaking. Now that's the telly. Now sometimes I struggle to put the talking device on. I press top left, hold it down, and hopefully it should come on. It doesn't always work. Now, if it doesn't work, I press the middle button, which is the AV button at the top, because it's 3 buttons at the top, and then the next sort of top left, and you've got to point it at the device. It's going to work now because it's gone off. Just let it load in. It takes quite a while to load in. Obviously, we stood right in front of it because sometimes, as I say, you've got to be very critical where you point this device. So just give it time to load in. It should be speaking very shortly. It's obviously switched on now. Just turn it up slightly. Right, so if I press a number, it goes to that channel. For example, 2.
2, BBC 2, to buy or not to buy, from 1:45 p.m. to 2:15 p.m.
It does take quite a time to switch on. So I'll just press 4. I've got it to beep when I press the numbers on the remote because the numbers sometimes don't respond. You can press it 4 or 5 times before anything happens, and for a totally blind person, you can't always tell whether it's responded. But if you put the beep in through the menus, it does then let you know it's responded. But I pressed it and nothing's happened. So here we go. Nothing's happened again.
Garden again isn't as big as my one.
So we'll just try it again.
Maybe I think a little bit
number four.
Probably a bit wacky, like them.
And it's playing up a bit because it's not responding. Let's just get a bit, point it a bit nearer.
First up on the
there you go.
Channel four racing from 1:05 PM to 3:10 PM.
So we've got a menu button on here, of course, and also we've got a digi guide. But again, it does take a bit of time to respond. Do the menu button now.
Main menu.
There's main menu.
There are six options. Current option 1, program guide layout.
So we'll go down with the cursor, if we can. And it is playing up a bit. I keep pressing it, but nothing. Ah, there we go.
2, say volume.
That's volumes. And we keep pressing it, and nothing's happening.
3,
there you go.
Audio description.
Audio description. So if you press enter, that will turn it on or off.
4, visual.
That's visual. Not bothered about that.
5, talking features.
That's your talking features.
6, language.
So there's your different options.
1. Program guide layout.
So we'll go back now to the television.
Main menu. There are 7 options. Current option. 1. Preferences.
That's preferences.
Press the where am I button. 2. Favorite.
Now that's where you can add a program to your favorites.
3. Parental controls.
It's been a bit more responsive now. So when I pick the
4. Reminders list.
Tape recorder up. And use one hand, it's not quite as easy.
Technical settings.
So there you can see the different settings. So we'll try and get it go to...
Returning to TV.
Now let's...
Channel 4.
That's channel 4.
Channel 4.
If we press enter button on this, it will... It'll give us a bit more of a mini guide and tell us what's in the mini guide. So we'll just now see if we can press the mini guide button.
That would be good enough to throttle one or two of the others.
Right, well, let's see if we can get the mini guide now. Right, here we go.
Program guide, grid view for channel 4. Channel 4 racing.
So let's press the right arrow now.
10 p.m. Stop. Countdown from 3, 10 p.m. to 4 p.m. For channel 4.
Press it again. Responding a bit better now.
Deal or no deal, banker's birthday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. for channel 4. Subtitles. Come dine with me from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. for channel 4. Come dine with me from 5 p.m. to The Simpsons.
Now if we go up arrow, I think it'll change the channels.
Subtitles.
There we go.
3, ITV1.
Yeah.
Calendar news.
Ah, so that's calendar news. So to go back to now, we've got to go back.
Subtitle. Britain's best dish from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. 3, ITV1. Miss Summer Murders from 4 p.m.
Going back again. Every time it bleeps, it means you've pressed it.
3, ITV1. Reminder set.
That's a reminder.
Reminder.
That's because we pressed the enter key. Let's go to the right, left again. Again, it's not responding, so... Oh, there we go.
60-minute makeover from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. 3, ITV1. Subtitles.
And then we'll press up arrow. That's it.
2, BBC 2, to buy or not to buy. From 1:45 p.m. to 2:15 p.m. Subtitles.
But I find it very difficult sometimes without the beep because you can't tell whether...
It's responded.
Block it. From 3 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. 2, BBC 2, put your money where your mouth is. Put your money where your mouth is. Point to it from 4:30 p.m. to 5, show me them on A. From 5:15 p.m. to 6 p.m.
So I'll go back to television now.
BBC 2, subtitles.
And we keep pressing the button and nothing's happening. We'll just get both hands, that's it.
Returning to TV for channel 4.
And then on here we've got audio description button at the bottom, a button to tell us where we are. I think it's very good, though the buttons are very, very poor when you press it to respond. I'm going to turn this off. That's normal telling out, and that's off. Very brief description there. I think it's obviously better than the Sky one that we've got over here in the UK. Again, with the buttons that you press, for a totally blind person, you must go in the menus. I think it's in volumes, and you've got to set the buttons to beep when it responds, because otherwise you're pressing the buttons and you're not sure what's happened. There's also a listing of channels button, and you can go down or up, and it lists all the channels, you know, like 5 Live Sport 705 and Radio 4704. So I think it's a tremendous piece of kit for a blind person because it speaks, and at least you have a good idea of what's happening, and you've got the guide that speaks to you. The only thing you can't do at the minute, I find, is record anything. You've not got the facility to do the recording. If anybody is interested, just give me an email on John, J-O-H-N, at chessplayer.demon.co.uk. I do use a chess program on the computer, just been playing chess for the English side. I just wish it would work better with Zerotech, but with System Access, but maybe I have to have a word with one of the chaps there. Fantastic. You know, the Zerotech's absolutely brilliant for us, System Access for Blind People. I think the people there do an absolutely splendid job, and that's why I subscribe to it, to give these people the backup who are putting in so much for us. To the listeners in the United States and England and all over, reporting for Serotalk, this is John Gallagher.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.